My name is Nicole Turgeon, and I'm a kidney pancreas transplant surgeon at the Emory Transplant Center. And I'm going to be discussing the kidney transplant operation and complications with you. Now, first, when you do a kidney transplant operation, there are some landmarks that you need to learn to be able to do the procedure. I'm going to draw an abdomen here, and again, please excuse my artwork as I'm not an artist. This is the umbilicus, and this is your pubic bone right here. This would be about your anterior superior iliac spine. These are the two landmarks that you're looking for when you're making the incision. Now again, there are many different ways to do the procedure and many different places to make the incision, but these landmarks will help you get into the proper space to do the kidney transplant procedure. Generally, I recommend doing it about 2 centimeters above the pubic bone and about 2 centimeters over from the anterior superior iliac spine. And then you can make sort of a curvy incision that will allow you, if you need to expand that incision if you need to get more access to the vessels higher up. Many people make different incisions that go more towards the anterior superior iliac spine or more vertical towards the umbilicus. This is really your choice. First, you make an incision through the skin, and then you carry that incision through the subcutaneous tissue and down to the external oblique fascia. You make an incision through the external oblique fascia, which will then expose the rectus muscle and fascia. In addition, you'll see the internal oblique muscle and fascia as well. Now, there are many different ways to get into the retroperitoneal space. One way is to go through that internal oblique muscle, and then you encounter the transversalis fascia and enter the space in that way. Another technique is to go near the rectus fascia and then enter into the retroperitoneum in that area as well. Whatever way you're comfortable is the way that you should enter into the retroperitoneal space. When you're into the retroperitoneal space, you want to be looking for some specific landmarks. Those include the psoas muscle and the external in common iliac arteries. In some cases, you may be fortunate enough to see the external iliac vein and common iliac vein, depending on where your incision is. Once you're in that space and you've identified the artery, you want to palpate that to be certain that it is your external iliac artery. And then you want to begin by dissecting the external iliac artery or common iliac artery and vein so that you're able to place clamps properly. You're going to be wanting to place a clamp on the external iliac vein, usually a side-biting clamp, but again, the clamps can be your choice. And you'll also be wanting to use clamps on the external or common iliac artery. Oftentimes, you use a proximal clamp and a distal clamp. After you have gained access to those vessels and you're comfortable that you are able to clamp them properly, you then will take the kidney that you've prepared on the back table and bring it into the operative field to start your anastomoses. Now, these anastomoses are going to be end-to-side anastomoses. So I'm going to, again, draw sort of a picture of the external iliac artery and vein. And this is going to be a picture of the kidney with a ureter. And then you're going to have an artery and a vein. And again, the location of the arteries and veins varies depending on which kidney you're using. And also, there may be multiple arteries and veins in each kidney. So first, you're going to do the venous anastomosis so that you don't clamp the external or common iliac artery too long. You certainly don't want to have too much limb ischemia, so that's something you want to avoid. When you're clamping the external iliac vein, after you do that, you make what's called a venotomy, which is a hole in the external iliac vein, and then you sew the renal vein to the external iliac vein in an end-to-side fashion. So they would be connected as such. Similarly, when you have completed doing that anastomosis, you then clamp the external iliac artery proximally and distally. You actually start with your distal clamp first, followed by your proximal clamp, and then you sew in an end-to-side fashion to the artery as well. When you're releasing clamps, the first clamp you release is the iliac vein clamp because you want to allow the kidney to have some outflow. And then you release the distal clamp of the iliac artery followed by the proximal clamp next to allow for the kidney to get reperfused. At this point, the kidney should turn pink fairly quickly. However, you may notice that there's some vasospasm in the blood vessels of the kidney from having some cold ischemia time or warm ischemia time or a combination of both. That should quickly resolve over time and you should see a uniformly pink kidney. Once you have completed the anastomoses, you then ensure that you do not have any significant bleeding from either the anastomoses or anywhere in the kidney itself, particularly in the hilum and in the retroperitoneum. And if you are comfortable that you don't have any significant bleeding, you can then move towards preparing the ureter for implantation into the bladder. Now, when we do the ureteral anastomosis, we are going to be cutting the ureter back to a fresh spot, and then we're going to be spatulating that ureter so we can sew it into the bladder. So ultimately, we will be having a fresh area of ureter that is going to be sewn into the anterior surface of the bladder. We perform a cystotomy, which is we make a hole in the bladder, and then we sew that ureter using a suture that is not permanent, an absorbable suture, which is very different than the suture we use for the vessels. We want that to be permanent suture or proline, and we'd like this suture to be absorbable, PDS. And that's because if we use a permanent suture in the bladder, we may be more prone to developing kidney stones in the future. Once we have completed the anastomosis, we do an anti-reflux procedure where we sew the muscle of the bladder over the anastomosis. It's really important not to make that too tight because you don't want to have a stricture at the anastomosis. Once you have completed the ureteral anastomosis, you then go back and ensure that you're comfortable with the hemostasis. And if you are, you proceed with closing the abdominal wall layers. You can do that in a single layer or of running suture or in an interrupted layer. And after that, you close the skin and the surgery is complete. Now we will be focusing on the surgical complications that occur immediately after the transplant and in some cases can occur late after transplant. Now the first category of complications are vascular complications. And there are two main vascular complications. The first is bleeding. And the second is thrombosis. Now, bleeding is self-explanatory in that there are big blood vessels that we're operating on and we sew anastomoses. So these could be potential sites for bleeding. In addition, there are other areas in the hilum that could bleed as well as in the retroperitoneum. One of the ways that you can determine if your patient is bleeding is if they're in the PACU or on the floor the next day and they are hypotensive, meaning they have low blood pressure, their heart rate is high, and in some cases they're complaining of severe pain that is not what you would expect to be normal pain after the transplant. If your patient is having these signs and symptoms, you may want to consider taking them immediately back to the operating room if they're hypotensive, because that could be very dangerous for them. If you suspect bleeding but their vital signs are stable, you may want to get some additional imaging to assist in making that diagnosis. Now, of course, on top of all of these physical findings and imaging findings, you would obviously check a hemoglobin and determine the trajectory of that hemoglobin. And if there was any concern, you would take the patient back to the operating room immediately. Now, bleeding occurs in only less than 2% of all kidney transplant recipients, so it's not a very common event. And it typically occurs in patients who have been on anticoagulation or who have other risk factors for bleeding. But it is an important surgical complication that you want to be mindful of after the kidney transplant. Now, focusing on thrombosis, thrombosis is the complication we fear the most, because that means that the patient goes home without a kidney. Now, both the renal artery and the renal vein can thrombose. Typically, the more common vessel that thromboses is the renal vein. How patients present is that they're making a lot of urine, usually in the living donor setting where the kidney works immediately, or in the deceased donor setting where the kidney is also working immediately, and then the urine output slows down to almost nothing. That's one sign. In addition, patients can sometimes look very ill as the kidney's thrombosing and have vital signs with tachycardia and sometimes even a little bit of hypotension. It's important to have a very high index of suspicion for thrombosis within the first 24 to 48 hours, but even within the hospital stay. And if there's any concern for thrombosis, the two ways to ensure that you don't have it are to check the blood flow with an ultrasound if you feel you have enough time to do that and you may not be compromising the kidney and you're really unsure. But if you're fairly certain that this was a living donor kidney that was working perfectly, you've checked your Foley, and there is no problem with that, you may want to just take the patient to the operating room immediately, because there is a slight chance you could save that kidney. However, as you probably remember, the kidney has an arterial supply that are end arteries, and oftentimes any amount of time that the kidney has had low to no blood flow will damage it and ultimately result in loss of the kidney. So while thrombosis is the complication we fear the most, it's also the one that we need to be the most vigilant about. The next category of complications are ureteral complications, and there are two main complications, leaks and strictures. Every patient will have a urinary catheter placed during surgery, and some patients may have urinary stents placed. Whether or not a urinary stent is placed during the procedure will depend on the program that you participate in. The ureteral stent will go from the patient's new kidney through the ureter, across the anastomosis, and into the bladder. Typically, stents are removed approximately 6 weeks after surgery to allow for the swelling at the anastomosis to resolve. And at that point, the anastomosis should be well healed. Now, when we're talking about leaks, leaks occur often within the first week after surgery. There can be small leaks and there can be large leaks. Depending on the size of the leak determines how that will be managed. A small leak can often be managed by using a stent and a urinary catheter for a period of time to allow it to heal. Most leaks will heal if they're small within about 6 weeks. Large leaks, on the other hand, need to be fixed in the operating room. And there are several different techniques that can be used a little bit beyond the scope of the talk today. So just know that if you have a large ureteral leak, you will need to go back to the operating room to repair it. Strictures often present where a patient's creatinine slowly creeps up, or they may stop making urine. And that can be a little bit more of a dramatic presentation, but sometimes happens. Now, strictures can occur along the way of the ureter. That's usually from ischemia. Or it can occur at the anastomosis. Again, it could be from ischemia, or it could be from a technical challenge of sewing the anastomosis too tight. Strictures can also be managed non-operatively as well as operatively, depending on the degree of the stricture. That also is far beyond the scope of our 10-minute talk today, but an important concept, and one that if you have a stricture, there is a less than 2% risk of it, and it can usually be fixed non-operatively. In the event you are not able to fix it non-operatively, you can then resort to operative management. So I think the take-home message of ureteral complications is they are usually fixable. It's very unlikely that a patient will lose a kidney from a ureteral leak or stricture. It can happen, but not typically from ureteral complications. Now, strictures also can occur late, but those are also not typically of surgical origin. They are frequently as a result of a virus called BK virus. The last set of complications are collections, and there are two main collections that can occur after surgery. One is a hematoma, and the other is a lymphocele. Now, a hematoma, as we mentioned, bleeding is a potential risk. So it doesn't occur in every case where you have a little bit of bleeding and you need to go back to the operating room, but you may develop a hematoma. Most hematomas can be left alone. However, if a hematoma is impacting the kidney function, the blood vessels, or the ureter, it's important that that be evacuated. Similarly, many patients develop lymphoceles. Lymphoceles can result from the lymphatic vessels that are dissected when you're getting the exposure for the kidney transplant around the iliac vessels, or they can also be from the hilum of the kidney. If a patient develops a lymphocele, most of them don't cause any trouble to the kidney, especially ones that are here out in the periphery of the kidney. However, again, as I mentioned with the hematoma, if you have a lymphocele that is in this area, or a hematoma, or a urine leak, any type of collection that's impacting the hilum or the ureter that could cause you to have an obstruction of the ureter, then you would want to evacuate that lymphocele. Now, there are two ways you can do that. You could go through the incision that you made for the kidney transplant and make what's called a peritoneal window by identifying the peritoneum and making a very long incision into the peritoneum so that lymph can drain into the peritoneum and be absorbed. Or you can approach it laparoscopically, where you make two small incisions or three, and you make a hole through the abdomen into the retroperitoneal space and, again, allow all of that fluid to drain into the abdomen. When you're doing it laparoscopically, it's important to make sure you make that incision long enough and that you avoid injury to the native ureter as well as to the kidney and the retroperitoneal space. Now, I did not mention obstruction under ureteral. That is one other complication that we just went over. And again, that's going to cause similar symptoms to stricture, where you may see that the patient is not experiencing as much urine output as they had previously, and their creatinine may also slightly rise. So I will add that on to the ureteral complications. And what I mean by obstruction is external obstruction from one of these complications. And the reason why we mention it now is because I wanted to present these two collections to you as a reason for a potential ureteral complication as well, but not a complication of the native ureter being sewed as an anastomosis. So, in summary, we reviewed the kidney transplant operation and then the general way in which you can approach the procedure. Again, I want to emphasize that every surgeon may have a different way of doing the surgery. This was just a simple way to understand what each step of the procedure is. And similarly, we went through the complications, how the patients present at a basic level, in addition to some of these complications, why they're so important to be vigilant about after the transplant. Appreciate your time and hope that I've helped you learn a little bit about the kidney transplant operation and complications. Thank you.